We're discussing Genesis chapter 2, and we've come down to number 4, the creation of woman. You notice on your outline sheet, there are several subpoints, the first of which is the need is demonstrated. We find this in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 and following. Verse 18 reads, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him an help fit for him." It's not good for man to be alone. And then the statement, as the King James translates it, "I will make him an help fit for him." The word translated there, "fit for him," suggests a correspondence or a likeness. If you look that, I won't give you the Hebrew term, but if you look that Hebrew word up in Brown, Driver, and Briggs' lexicon, you will find that the definition there is a help equal and adequate to himself. A help equal and adequate to himself. So the Lord says it's not good that man should be alone. He should have a help who corresponds to himself, who is equal and adequate to himself. I don't think the term help implies inferiority. If you go back to chapter 1, you find that both man and woman were created in the image of God, and they stand as equal before God, as created in his image. But the woman is to be a help for the man, not his slave. She is one who complements the man, who corresponds to the man. But before God gave the woman to Adam, Adam is told that he is to name all the creatures, all the animals. So you read in verse 19 that the Lord brought all these beasts of the field and fowl of the air to Adam to see what he would call them. And verse 20 says Adam gave names to all the cattle, to the fowl of the air, to every beast of the field. But the last phrase of verse 20, "there was not found a help equal and adequate unto himself," that corresponded to himself. And I think the point of this inclusion of this material here is to emphasize and bring out that in all these other living creatures, there was not a creature that corresponded to Adam, that was like Adam. There was a difference between Adam and the creatures, and he became aware of that. When it says Adam was to name those creatures, it seems to me there's probably more than just giving a label to each of them that's involved. He probably characterized them in some way by their names, which would involve understanding something about the differences between the animals. But in that process, he becomes acutely conscious of the difference between himself and the animals, and his need for fellowship with a partner who had a likeness unto himself. So that is the reason that you find after God creates woman in verses 21 and 22, that Adam says, "Now at last," this is "now" in the King James, "bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh." "Now at length," now at last, after having surveyed all these other creatures and seen that there was not one that corresponded to himself, now woman does. So first, the need is demonstrated. Secondly, woman is not the product of evolutionary development. Now you read, in verse 21, "The Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof." That's reading from the King James. So the Lord brings this deep sleep, like an anesthesia, you might say, upon Adam. And while he sleeps, as the King James translates it, God took one of his ribs. And from it, he made a woman in verse 32. The Hebrew word for rib, which is used here,
for those of you who have had Hebrew,
the Hebrew word in the singular. It's in a plural form here, because you notice it says he took one of his ribs. Now, that word is difficult to translate in this context. The interesting thing is that in its other occurrences, it generally has the meaning of side. This is the only place where it is translated rib in entirety of the Old Testament. If you look up usage of the term, you will find wide variety of usage, but always with the idea of a side. Or not always, but usually with the idea of a side. Exodus 25:12. Thou shalt cast four rings of gold for it, put them in the four corners thereof, and two rings shall be on the one side of it, two rings on the other side of it. And it's talking about the Ark of the Covenant. So one side of the Ark, the other side of the Ark. And that's this term. Verse 14, it's the same. By the sides of the Ark it speaks of with this term. Exodus 27:7. The stave shall be put into the rings, the staves shall be upon the two sides of the altar. There it's used with respect to the altar, the two sides of the altar. 26:20. And for the second side of the tabernacle, on the north side, there shall be 20 boards. Side of the tabernacle. In 2 Samuel 16:13, David and his men went by the way. 1 Samuel 16:13. Must be. It's the wrong verse. Wait a second. 1 Kings 6:15 is a reference I'm coming to, but in a minute. 2 Samuel 16:13. I just didn't read far enough. And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hillside, the side of the hill. 2 Samuel 16:13. Now the problem is, in the context of Genesis 2:21, you have a plural form, and it's preceded by one of in the Hebrew. So you see, as he slept, he took one of whatever this term is. And probably because of the use of this term in 1 Kings 6:15, the idea of rib has been chosen as an appropriate translation. 1 Kings 6:15 uses the term. Where you read of Solomon building the temple, he built the walls of the house inside with boards of cedar. Now, boards is this word in the plural form again. Boards of cedar. It's an unusual use of it, but in the context it seems clearly to indicate boards. Both the floor of the house, the walls of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood, covered the floor of the house with planks of fir. Planks is this term. Selah in the plural form. So with that kind of a use in 1 Kings 6:15, with the combination of one of, prior to the use of the term here in Genesis 2:21, many have come to the conclusion that the best translation for it in this context is rib. He took one of the ribs, even though this is not a term that's elsewhere used for rib. How's the NIV translated? Check that. Ribs. What about NASV? Probably ribs too. Does anybody have an NASV? Ribs. Okay. I don't know. I think I would say that to translate it ribs is perhaps more explicit than the usage of the Hebrew term would suggest. But I can't suggest a better translation. You could say he took from the side and leave what he took from the side sort of unexpressed as a possibility. But that doesn't do justice to the plural form. So you see that's where you are with the problem. translation. Yes, it's one of in the construct prior to the plural form of this. Yes. So, you know, you often have this discussion, or maybe you haven't come across it. You read some of the literature. This passage is often made fun of. The Lord took the rib from a woman. Does a woman have one less rib than a man? And, you know, the whole thing is sort of ridiculed from that perspective, which I don't think, you know, has a great deal of bearing on how we understand this. The point is, what does the term mean? And there's a certain obscurity on exactly what this term means in this context. Rib's a reasonable translation, but perhaps a bit more explicit than you can get from its usage elsewhere. In any case, another thing that reinforces the idea of rib is Adam's statement in verse 23. When he sees woman, he says, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh." And some push there the expression, "bone of my bones." The bone was taken. But the question is whether that is intended to be pushed to that extent in the literal sense, or whether it is more figurative, indicating close relationship. In 2 Samuel 5:1, you read, "Then came all the tribes of Israel unto Hebron to speak to David, and spoke, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. We are thy bone and thy flesh," all the tribes of Israel saying to David. Obviously, the expression there is simply one of a close relationship. He was one of them. Perhaps you would say the same thing in Genesis 2:23 of Adam's expression. "Here is this one who corresponds to me, who has been built from that which was taken from me." Yes. That was 2 Samuel 5:1. Question.
The thing that, instead of just concentrating on ribs and bones, but if you look at the following thing in verse 21, they closed up the place with flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look down at the end of 23, where she was taken out of it.
That's right. I think that's the point. Whether it was,
to support any ambiguity that may be there.
Well, I think whether it was specifically a rib that was taken, clearly something was taken from man. His flesh was opened. He was in this deep sleep. And from what was taken, woman was created. That may have been a rib. It may have been more than a rib. It's taken from the side of man, obviously. All right, the point is, though, that when Adam awakes and sees woman, he recognizes something of himself. And the expression is given then in verse 23. In Hebrew, in poetic form, I think if you look at the NIV, you can see that the way the lines are set up. It's not in prose formulation, but in that of poetry. And he says, "This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Among the animals, he had not found such a partner. But now he discovers the help that corresponds to himself, that is like himself, which God has given to him for a partner. And he recognizes the unity which exists between himself and the woman." All right, C is the meaning of woman's being created out of man. I think it's clear that there is significance here, not only with respect to the origin of woman coming from man as a special creative act of God, but there's also significance here with respect to the institution and nature of marriage. And I think we find that in verse 24, because immediately you read the statement, "Therefore, shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. On your bibliography, I have referred under this head to Francis Schaeffer, Genesis in Space and Time, page 45. Schaeffer says, certainly the fact of the woman's creation out of the man has a very definite philosophical importance because it means that mankind is really a unit. Man didn't just come out of nowhere, nor has he sprung up from numerous starts. There was a real beginning, a beginning in a real unity in one man, one individual, differentiated from all that preceded him, then differentiated in terms of male and female. It is this picture of man which gives strength to the Christian concept of the unity of mankind. The world today is trying to find a basis for claiming all men are one. But the Christian does not have this problem, for he understands why mankind is really united. Furthermore, we can begin to understand something about marriage, because God himself ties the marriage bond into the reality of the unity of mankind. Hence, we can understand something of that particular union when the male and female constitute one whole, become one flesh. Man with a capital M equals male and female. And the one man, one woman union reunites that unity. Now, most interpreters are agreed that the statement in verse 24 is the words of the writer, not a continuation of the words of Adam. You see in verse 23, Adam is speaking. Adam says, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Now you get not a continuation of Adam speaking, but a comment by the writer. It doesn't make it any less the word of God. And in fact, this verse is alluded to by Christ in Matthew 19:5. The question is, with respect to verse 24, is this to be taken as an explanation or a command? Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Is that an explanation of something that happens all the time? Or is it an injunction, a command, that man must do that? There are those who have taken it as a command. The Hebrew syntax there would allow it to be understood either way. It's an imperfect verbal form. Man shall leave his father and his mother. An imperfect tense in Hebrew can be used as an injunctive, expressing a strong command. Or it can be taken as frequentative or habitual, something that always happens. Among those who took it in the first sense as a command were John Calvin. He says the shall is not to be taken as a future, but in the sense of must. Therefore, a man must leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife. And his comment is on the basis of the creative process, the way in which woman was formed, man must do this. Grammatically, it's possible to understand it that way. But it's also possible to take it as a fact and the explanation of a fact, and I think that's preferable. In other words, what you have in verse 24 is an explanation of why it is that a man leaves his father and his mother and is united with his wife. Why does man do that? Why does that happen with regularity? Why is that the normal thing, you might say? Well, the reason lies in the creation. God created man and woman as a unity, and man and woman are made to seek that unity in fellowship with one another as the two become one flesh. Now, I think the implication of all that is that monogamous marriage is rooted in creation. That's what the second point there, Schaeffer, spoke about the unity of mankind generally. But you also have the idea here that monogamous marriage is rooted in creation. You have the explanation for that inner unity between a man and his wife. Why is that? Well, it's because they originally were one. And now in the marriage relationship, that unity is restored. Man knows then, by divine revelation from Genesis 2, in this account, that woman was taken from his own body, and that in the marriage relationship, you have something of the restoration of that original unity. The expression there, become one flesh. They shall be one flesh. I don't think that should be understood as being restricted to the physical sexual union. It certainly involves that and includes that. And the unity between man and woman finds expression in that. There's the comment in 1 Corinthians 6:16, what know ye not that he who is joined to an harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. Certainly that's speaking there of the physical union. But I think there's much more than that involved in the statement. They shall cleave, man shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. The unity, it seems to me, that's involved there is spiritual, emotional, psychological, as well as physical. It's a very complex thing. They're all interrelated. And again, I think that underlines and underscores the fact that for that kind of unity, monogamy is essential. Yeah.
Is the word used for flesh in that verse 23, the same?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think it's basar. But I think the point that's being addressed there is that so significant is the marriage bond that two people are no longer two. In other words, they become interdependent. They're drawn into a unity of that involves not only a physical relationship, but a spiritual, psychological, emotional union between two people. Any questions, comments? Yeah. The therefore a man shall leave. In the Hebrew it's ya'azav. Question is whether that is precognitive or whether it's an imperative conjunction. He will leave. And I think that if those of you who have had Hebrew initials, Williams, R.J. Williams. Are you familiar with this book on Hebrew syntax? You can, for these two uses, the imperative and the frequentative, section 173 and 168. He discusses those two uses. Okay, let's go on to five. What about evolution? Again, three subpoints. First, meaning of the term. I think when we talk about evolution, we have to realize that the term is often used in different ways. Most frequently, it is used for the theory that every living thing has come from natural causes and developed from the simple to the complex by the process of natural selection. Every living thing has come from natural causes and developed from the simple to the complex by the process of natural selection. Now, that's the macroevolutionary theory, amoeba to man sort of idea that originally, in some very ancient past, things came together under such conditions that the life principle was created, and then that began to differentiate itself, and through the process of time and natural selection, eventually all the variety of living things that we now know has come through that process. That's the common meaning of and use of the term, and I think we can say without any qualification that there's no way that that idea can be harmonized with the creation account of Genesis 1 through 3. Now, the interesting thing is that particularly in the last 10, 15 years, very serious questions about the evolutionary theory have been raised by competent scientists. Even, and I'm not thinking here about the creation scientists, you know, the evangelical community of scientists who have raised questions about the evolutionary theory, but by competent scientists who are not committed to a Christian view of origins. Even by such people, serious questions are being raised about the evolutionary theory. One illustration of that is listed on your bibliography. Top of page 9, the third entry, Sir Fred Hoyle. And I'm not sure how you pronounce the co-author, Chandra Wickramasinghe, or something to that effect. The title of the book is Evolution from Space. I don't know if any of you heard of that book when it was released. It's 1981. It's not too long ago. I have a review here of it that gives somewhat of an idea of the content of the book. And let me read you some parts from this review. The review says, an eminent British scientist has mounted a new assault on the Darwinian evolutionary theory, saying the possibility of it being true are so utterly minuscule as to be absurd. And, of course, the author is Sir Fred Hoyle, internationally recognized astronomer and mathematician. He's associated with the Royal Astronomical Society. He's taught at leading universities in England and the United States as well. The review goes on to say, he directly challenges both the Darwinian concept of gradual evolution of different life forms from common origins and also that the first living cells developed by random processes in some primordial ooze. The chances of that happening are not sensibly different from zero, he says. Hoyle, 67 years old, with numerous honors in his field, and he's not a Christian. So, you know, his approach to this is not based on Scripture, it's based on his scientific analysis of the situation. He says biomolecules are now known to be so enormously complex that quite explicit instructions were necessary for their assembly, and that other means than natural selection were required for life's development. The requisite information came from an intelligence. Now, he's not willing to call the intelligence God, but he says it has to come from an intelligence. The beckoning specter, he calls it. The new evidence points clearly and decisively to a cosmic origin of life. His idea is that life came to this planet from outer space somewhere. But what he's saying is you cannot explain the complexity and the many different life forms on the basis of this evolutionary theory, which he thinks is nonsense. In making the case, these two authors, array findings of microbiology, mathematics, computer technology, and the fossil record against the Darwin theory, declaring it has been undercut by new knowledge. They say paleontologists for years have recognized that the slow evolutionary connections required by the theory did not happen, but it hasn't made much impression on general opinion. The chances of random chemical shufflings in some primordial soup producing the complex basic enzymes of life are only 1 to 10 to the 40,000th power, or 1 followed by 40,000 zeros, the two scientists calculate. In effect, they say the chances are so outrageously small, it would be incredible even if the whole universe consisted of organic soup. Darwinian evolution, this is a quote from them, is most unlikely to get even one polypeptide chain of essential life substances right, let alone the thousands on which living cells depend for survival. This situation is well known to geneticists, and yet nobody seems to blow the whistle decisively on the theory. If Darwinism were not considered socially desirable, it would, of course, be otherwise. And so he's saying that the reason for the persistence of the theory is not its scientific basis as being a convincing theory. It's something that is desirable socially. He said, they note their own revolt. Well, I should read the previous sentence. Once a whole society becomes committed to a particular set of concepts, educational continuity makes it exceedingly hard to change the pattern, the authors say. You either have to believe the concepts or you will be branded a heretic. They note their own revolt has been greeted not with furious attack as they expected, but with a wall of silence in scientific journals, which tend to accept any hypothesis in order to uphold Darwinism. I'll skip down just a couple more statements. Every competent space mathematician would assure you that such a Darwinian idea had no chance of working. And what they're talking about there is mutations being that which explains the progression into higher life forms. Every computer expert will, in fact, assure you throwing random mistakes into a computer is no way to improve it. Darwinism is not only inadequate to explain the evolutionary changes that have occurred sometimes over quite short intervals for both plants and animals, it is woefully inadequate, the authors say. Now, I read at some length from that review just as an illustration of one example of the kinds of questions that are being raised recently about evolutionary theory. Yet, as they say, in the scientific community at large, the theory is not really being dispensed with. It's very hard to move the accumulated investment of time and energy and theory and writing and commitment and all the rest of it that's involved in supporting the evolutionary theory. Question. This review, I don't have a date from. I took it. It's written by George Carnell, the AP religion writer, out of a newspaper. And I don't have the date on the sheet. I'm sure you could look the book up, though, the entry here, and find some reviews of it, general reviews. If you wanted a copy of this, I could give you a copy of this. Yeah. Oh, really? Well, that kind of thing, yeah, it just continues. Let me, in connection both with Hoyle's book and some of these ideas generally, refer you to Carl Henry's discussion in God, Revelation, and Authority. That's the second entry there on the top of page 9. There's a long section where he discusses the present situation with respect to evolutionary theory. And it's a chapter well worth reading, the whole chapter here. But on page 178, he discusses Hoyle's book. And he says that Hoyle and Wickram Singh project the possibility, discussed also by a couple other people, that life arrived on Earth from outer space.